It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, same-sex marriage is now a legal reality in Arizona, but there may still be bumps along the way. And is there another significant social movement around the corner? We'll talk about that. Also, the list of community gathering places disappearing from the valley is growing. Karsha's, Mary Coyle's, and Baker's Nursery have all closed in recent months. Is authentic Phoenix going away? Shannon Scutari and the Rogue columnist John Talton will weigh in, and we'll glance into the possible distant future on how science fiction can lead to big ideas. We start today's program with Arizona's economy. Our budget deficit is growing, even as the major party gubernatorial nominees, Fred Duvall and Doug Ducey, tout big plans. So what kind of shape are we really in? I'm joined by Jim Rounds, economist and senior vice president for Elliott D. Pollack & Company. Jim, welcome back.
How you doing, Steve?
Jim, first of all, this deficit sounds enormous. We're talking about even the next fiscal year close to $1 billion. How do we get there?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. It's a cumulative effect. So it's not as if we're $1 billion in the hole in 1 year. This is going to be over a 3 year period, probably. About half of it has to do with non-K-12 issues. So we know about the lawsuit related to K-12 and funding for inflation. That's probably about half, a little bit more, depending on how that may be resolved. And then the other part has to do with, I don't want to say how the state's being managed, but it has to do with a weak economy and maybe being a little bit overly eager on some prior forecasts.
Let's talk briefly about structural deficit. That phrase always comes up.
Yeah.
How does that relate to the rest of the deficit we're seeing?
Well, that's about half of it. And so that's where you're permanently spending more than you're bringing in, and you're not going to see that get resolved. So something has to change. So when you hear it as structural, what that basically means is the government's going to have to make some tough decisions because it's not just going to work itself out. And that's what we see right now.
Regardless of what you think of either one of the plans, I mean, if we want to stereotype, we're saying that Fred Duvall would like to get in and invest and spend a little bit more. Doug Ducey has talked about eliminating the income tax, though he's pulled back a little bit from that in recent weeks. Are they going to be able to do much of anything when you walk into a deficit like that?
I think they're going to spend most of their time for the next couple or 3 years working on the budget. And really, that's the legislature and the governor's office's main job. You work on economic development and other things as you can, but it's to balance the budget. And even balancing the budget is an economic development tool. You have a state that can't balance its budget, and there's uncertainty related whether or not it's going to raise taxes, like Kansas found itself in that position. That's not good for economic development. So even just balancing the budget is a decent economic development tool. And Duvall's going to be looking at ways to protect education funding. He's going to be hard-pressed to find additional funding, but he's probably more in support of the inflation increase. Ducey's going to be hoping for some tax reductions, maybe economic development plans. It's going to be hard to find extra money for that. Now, longer term, let's say they had two terms. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that some of these things could be implemented, and Ducey was making a big deal out of that. A lot of my plans are over two terms. There's actually some to that, but this first term is going to be dominated by the budget.
Legitimate options, though, when it comes to deciding how to figure this out. Obviously, Governor Brewer supported the temporary sales tax increase, which was supposed to be focused primarily on K-12 education. In this sort of environment, which is so anti-tax increase, anti-revenue increase, however we want to phrase it, I mean, are we actually going to have to look that way even with a Republican in office, or they're going to have to be bells and whistles? What comes to mind for you, even if these aren't implemented, things that might have to be done incrementally?
So the budget at the state is tremendously complex. There's probably three or four people in the entire state that really understand the budget components and the revenue components. And there's always something that you can find. There's always something clever that you can find. You can use a rainy day fund to bridge part of this gap. Can they find another $500 million? I'm sure they can find some ways of managing it. So I think what they're going to have to do is treat the development of the budget that they're doing right now and what will be developed into January when they introduce it in the governor's office and the legislature. This is when they put together the detailed budgets. Hope that the economy improves a little bit more than it has been. And so recent activity really influences the most recent forecast. And recent economic activity has been relatively weak. I think that there's some upside to that. So if the numbers improve a little bit by January, they may have a little bit more wiggle room in trying to bridge that gap in the deficit, and then they'll have to get clever. I don't think they're going to need a tax increase. And actually, I don't even know will they possibly need it. I don't think that they're going to even consider it. Mm-hmm. So they will have to find something clever.
Boy, Jim, those are different things, though. Again, not to talk too much about the politicians, but it's different to think you don't really need it or you're not even going to consider it. I mean, is that an issue, though, even for both sides to say, in Duvall's case, okay, I'd like to spend more, I'd like to invest more, we can't do it right now. And on the Ducey side or the more conservative Republican lawmaker side, it almost seems like even considering this makes them some sort of, I don't know, heathens of some sort.
It's okay in the political debate. It's okay to have one side saying we'd really like to look at these things that are important. Investing in transportation infrastructure and education is important, and the only way we can do it is with a tax increase. And then you have another side saying, no, the tax policy is the most important. It's okay as long as there's a meeting of the minds and they come to something reasonable. But what I've found is that when you have a large number of people trying to resolve a problem, you never get a good solution. What you got to do is find two or three really smart people to go in there and look at the books and make some recommendations on how to fix this thing. And if you look at our history, whenever we've had some major budget problems, that's actually how some things got done behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Jim Rounds, Senior VP at Elliott D. Pollack & Company. Jim, let's talk specifically about Arizona's economy and what we're bringing in as far as revenue goes. Based on this budget deficit, how much of that is attributable to the state just not coming out, still not quite out of the recession in the sense that people wanted to? Obviously, we're not in a recession anymore, but we haven't grown in the sense in the way that people expected us to.
Well, we're growing, but you have to really break that down into a discussion by government entity. So you could look at a particular county, and even though the economy's been weak, they might be in great shape. You go across the street to City Hall, and they're having a problem because of some policy decisions. At the state, it's probably a combination of both. But again, I think that there's a little bit more upside than downside, at least based on the last forecast development. And we gave a presentation down at the Capitol, and I was a little bit more optimistic than the group as a whole. And it's so hard. I mean, us economists are wrong so often. People aren't going to trust us. But in this case, I do think that there's some upside for Arizona compared to where we were this last year. We're still steadily improving.
What's looking good to you right now? I don't want to make too big a deal out of what happened in Mesa, but of course, that was supposed to be this big highlight. Apple supplier, et cetera, we know that's going by the wayside. How much does something like that concern you? Because it's not really related to Arizona, per se.
Yeah, look, this is going to get me in trouble with a lot of the economic developers, but when you work on improving the economy, when you work on tax policy, you work on economic development programs, you're not going to change the way the economy functions overnight. No program or tax cut is going to improve the economy unless you do really solid quality policy over many, many years and you're consistent. And so while some of these things are important, it's really not what's driving the economy. The private sector growth and who we are and our economic base is what's causing us to grow. And so people say, well, we need a more diverse economy. That's what we should be focusing on. But you can't do that in a year or two. It takes a while. So we need to embrace who we are. We're a state that needs population growth. We need to see people coming here, but we're getting at the point where you're going to see people a little bit more mobile across the country. And if we can take advantage of that and we have some moderate population growth, we see some continued employment growth, I think we'll be okay long run. But I think people get a little bit excited when they feel that the government can positively influence the economy. The government can really screw stuff up, but it can positively influence the economy over multiple years of doing good policy.
Right. As you said, planning, like with anything, people get so impatient, they want things to happen right now. So at this stage, looking forward into what we're going to have going into 2015, you know, we had this after the recession. We're projecting, when is Arizona going to return to pre-recession growth patterns? And we really haven't gotten there yet. What are you most optimistic about as far as what year? I mean, what are some factors Arizona has to look at in order to get back to that level we want?
Well, we look at tons and tons of data points when we try to put together our opinion. But you really want to focus on, what does the population picture look like in terms of people moving here? What does housing and construction look like? Because unfortunately, that is a big part of our economy still.
You mentioned construction again, Jim.
Yeah. And then you can't always just take a look at the last several months. You have to try to figure out, are things pointing to a turning point in the economy? And that's really hard to predict, because you can draw a line between two data points with a crayon and a ruler and say, here's my forecast. And some people might do that. But if you look at all the data, it's suggesting that we're going to improve again next year and maybe at a little more rapid rate. But the timing is critical. If you miss that by half a fiscal year, then it could totally blow up your budget. So the state has to lag a little bit in terms of its policy. So it's good it's being conservative right now, and it can hope for some upside in terms of additional revenues being available. And then it's going to have to go through some of those painful things and figure out how to maybe find another $400 or $500 million.
But Jim, finally, is this the new normal? Because we expected, again, to come out of this recession and Arizona to be popping like we always did. Is this something we're going to have to get used to? Sort of steady growth and nothing too spectacular?
It's tough to say that. I like to not put too much on the last couple of years because this was an unusual downturn. So this is the new normal for the next couple or 3 years. If we end up having a downturn in the next 3 or 4 years, it's going to be very mild. And I think the next business cycle will look a little bit more like the normal Arizona business cycle. But right now, the politicians have to expect only moderate growth and new normal, but only 3 or 4 years, maybe.
Jim Rounds, economist and senior vice president for Elliott DePollock & Company. Jim, thank you as always.
Thanks.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Next Monday marks the deadline for Shanisha Taylor to move $60,000 into a trust fund for her children. Taylor is the Phoenix single mom who was charged by prosecutors for leaving her children in the car while she attended a job interview. Prosecutors agreed to dismiss the charges if Taylor met a series of requirements, including putting thousands of dollars in donations to her cause aside for her children. The Taylor situation brings into focus the difficulties homeless people, especially those with children, have in searching for a job. Earlier, I spoke with Mark Holleran about that. Holleran's the CEO of Central Arizona Shelter Services, or CAS.
You know, we've been dealing with these sort of employment challenges for the last several years, and it's a multiple of things, unfortunately. With the economic downturn that hit especially the Valley, a lot of the jobs that the homeless individuals that we serve, the service jobs, the landscaping, the entry-level construction jobs, those type of jobs, the low-paying jobs, all but disappeared. And ultimately, here we are in 2014, and most of those jobs have not returned. And on top of that, what happened was a lot of people who had all kinds of experience, even doctorates, these were individuals that were taking jobs because they just needed some sort of cash flow. And so they sort of crowded out the marketplace that ultimately, you know, had been filled by individuals that we see in our shelter system. So, you know, in this sort of environment, the homeless individuals that we're serving are incredibly challenged. As opposed to 5 or 6 years ago. And if you're in a family or you have children, trying to figure out what to do with your children while you're engaged in this sort of general search, very, very challenging. And if you're trying to do it by yourself, then you have to have access to computers, how do I apply, mm-hmm. you know, and it gets absolutely overwhelming.
Mark, in a general sense, what is out there, what options are there, and what specifically is CAS doing to try to help folks out?
We spend a lot of time with employers, and what we try to do is, first, we sit down with the homeless individuals that we serve directly, and we try to figure out what their past experiences are, what their interests are. We help them with their resume preparation, general hygiene, help them with things like appropriate clothing, and then we sit down and say, all right, this is how you would respond and go through sort of mock interviews. And then at the same time, we're trying to work with outside employers that many of them are receiving so many resumes that, you know, getting to even open up that door is very, very difficult. So we try to establish these relationships and say, listen, if you will take this chance, and unfortunately they feel like they're taking a chance, here's what we can provide. And we try to get those individuals to work on time if you'll hire them. We'll make sure that they're appropriately dressed. We'll make sure that they come with a lunch. We try to prepare them for success and make it as risk-free to the prospective employer as possible. But even that in this environment is incredibly challenging.
And Mark, how much more difficult can it be for someone in the homeless situation, even with the assistance that you're talking about providing, whether it comes to getting ready, even just the appearance comes out of it? I kind of wonder whether it's even more discouraging for someone in that situation who perhaps doesn't get the call back after making that effort that perhaps was even more monumental for them than it would be for an average person who's been out of work for a short time. How do you overcome that if there's that second obstacle that comes in? Well, I tried and they didn't want me, so what am I going to do now?
Well, we spend a lot of time with each individual. We get them there. We get them back. We sit down. We go over, you know, what happened during the interview process. We try to get across to them that, you know, don't take this personally. You'll probably get rejections. And, you know, even you and I, if we were out in looking for employment right now, we would get many, many rejections. Mm-hmm. And we're theoretically best equipped to deal with that sort of rejection. So it is a significant challenge. And we have a lot of individuals that just give up, which then, you know, almost is, I don't want to say, you know, sort of the end of their working life, but I think you see more and more these days, especially people that have been out of work for an extended period of time, they have just effectively given up. So it's a constant challenge for us, ultimately, to achieve our mission. Either we serve our clients and they, you know, qualify for certain benefits because of maybe disabilities, or in order to help them become self-sufficient, they must be able to find a job. And it is very challenging in this current environment.
Mark, in a broader sense, do you think the public at large understands how difficult that is?
Well, I will tell you, perhaps the general public is starting to get a sense of this, especially if they have teenagers or young adults in their families. I will tell you that at CAS, our 18 to 24-year-old population has tripled in the last 3 years. And 3 years ago, the three top reasons for 18 to 24-year-olds showing up at our shelter was kicked out by family, kicked out by friends, lost my job. Now, the number one issue is lost my job. And so I think the mainstream public now is experiencing, you know, these challenges. I think, you know, what you could call it the social contract, even for young adults coming out of college. You know, it was under, you know, the theory was you go to college, you get the borrow money, that's fine. When you get out, you'll have a job, you'll pay that back. And more individuals that are even theoretically trained for a profession are coming out of college and not able to find jobs. It's very, very challenging. And so if you don't have those tools, then immediately you're going to face a challenge that makes it almost impossible for you to compete.
Mark Holleran is the CEO of Central Arizona Shelter Services. And still to come on Here and Now, last week same-sex marriage became a legal reality in Arizona. We'll talk about broader social movements and how they come to be. And a little bit later on, is Authentic Phoenix disappearing? We'll talk about it. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Peoria Subaru, offering a selection of new AWD vehicles, including the 2015 Subaru Forester, Outback Legacy, and more. Locally owned and operated for 25 years by the Moore family, online at PeoriaSubaru.com.
Good morning. This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Sunny skies across most of Arizona right now. It's 63 degrees up at the Grand Canyon, 60 in Flagstaff, 79 in Casa Grande, 80 degrees in Tucson, and 87 right now in Yuma. Thanks to all of our members who made the News and Journalism Member Drive a success. We heard from over 1,100 new and sustaining members. Your support makes possible the high-quality public service you expect. If you didn't have the opportunity to make your gift of support, you can still do so at KJZZ.org. And thank you. A couple of things to watch out for on the Valley freeways right now. On I-10 eastbound, there's a crash on the shoulder near the I-17 stack, and another on I-17 northbound, that's on the shoulder at Buckeye Road. Mostly sunny skies and 83 degrees in Phoenix at 11:25.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Last Friday, same-sex marriage became a legal reality in Arizona. For many gays and lesbians in the state, that result felt like it was a very long time coming, considering the actions of other states and municipalities in past years. And the process of same-sex marriage gaining broader acceptance started in a more modest way, though, as most social movements do. So what goes into bringing about major social change, and what's still left to do in the realm of same-sex marriage? With me are Madeline Adelman, Associate Professor of Justice and Social Inquiry at ASU School of Social Transformation. Madeline, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
And joining us by phone is Katrina Kimport, Assistant Professor at the Center for Global Reproductive Health at the University of California, San Francisco. She's also the author of Queering Marriage, Challenging Family Formation in the United States. Katrina, good morning to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let me start with you, Katrina. For those not directly involved, it may seem like, especially in Arizona, I want Madeline to comment on this as well, it seemed like this was sort of an overnight sensation, but this has been such a long time coming. How much has the movement changed? How did it initially get developed, again, in a place like California, which is usually more progressive on issues like this?
Absolutely. It's got a long, long history. In fact, some people trace the interest by same-sex couples in marriage to the early 70s. And so there are ways of answering that question that think both about within the larger gay and lesbian movement, when did marriage become a predominant issue? There's also questions about when did marriage become something that might be of interest or potential success on a political front. But the idea of legalizing same-sex marriage really gained momentum in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people trace that to the Massachusetts decision in 2003 that legalized marriage in Massachusetts, starting in 2004, and then in San Francisco when the mayor here issued same-sex couples marriage licenses in a sort of act of civil disobedience. And those two things are usually cited as really spurring both the gay and lesbian movement to take on marriage more explicitly and also cueing to the larger public that there is both an interest in and a pathway to legalizing marriage for gay couples.
Madeline, what are your thoughts on that, first of all? And also, I wanted you to jump on the fact that a lot of people in Arizona do think this just sort of happened a lot in the last few weeks.
Sure. Just file a few papers and we're done. Where it's so easy. First, I really appreciate Katrina's viewpoints, particularly from her perspective as a sociologist. I happen to be an anthropologist. And so we're really interested in how people make meaning and what matters to them. So I think to build on her comments, the idea that same-sex marriage was even thinkable was fomented by some of these turning points that she referred to, Massachusetts, California. And so people's excitement and emotional investment increased because of those public activities. However, the success that we've seen would not be possible if the infrastructure, if the social movement community had not already been there. So people's excitement could be tapped into and mobilized by the people on the ground who were eager to move forward on marriage.
And Madeline, how often is it when people are on the ground, are they directly involved? How much can a movement really gain momentum when people who aren't even necessarily going to be affected? I mean, just people who are heterosexuals decide, you know, this is a good idea, I want to help out with this too.
Sure. So people get involved for all different kinds of reasons. And a lot of times it's very, very personal. It could be just a personal experience. I have a colleague of mine on a board of a national organization who got involved because of a personal tragedy. So a loss of her child spurred her to get involved in trying to change the world around her because she thought, you know, the way the schools are organized right now, they're not working. So personal experience, whether it's a loss, a tragedy, a euphoric kind of moment that people have, perhaps the excitement of seeing a sibling or a parent get involved or interested or committed to same-sex marriage could spur someone to get involved. Clearly, the notion of coming out, we just finished celebrating National Coming Out Day. Mm-hmm. The notion of coming out was central to the success of the same-sex marriage here in Arizona and elsewhere.
Katrina, I wonder if you could comment on what Madeline had to say and how that impacted the expansion of same-sex marriage, the expansion of the acceptance of it. Because when you mention what happened in Massachusetts, that was at a time where there was not this broader acceptance. There wasn't this feeling. It's almost like you have to have the pioneers who take some of the hits early to really make the movement go.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think there's another piece. I want to echo everything that both of you just said, but the other piece that happens along with the personal connections and the personal experiences that introduce the idea of marriage and compel people to start being interested in it is also the role of what we usually call elites. So that can be political elites, so lawmakers, executives, including President Obama with his statement about evolving on the issue of gay marriage. It can be celebrities, so people like Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, who publicly said they wouldn't marry until gay couples could also be married. That we can't discount the role that this plays in making the idea of gay marriage more normal, more accessible, more able to be envisioned when you have people in cultural positions of leadership also stepping forward and voicing their support. So there's sort of, in marriage, part of why I think we feel like it happened so rapidly is that both of these things ended up happening kind of in concert, and both sort of seemed to hit a threshold of greater mainstream familiarity at the same time. So you had people having personal experiences, the coming out, familiarity, learning more about the presence of gay people in their lives, and then also seeing in public spaces support for the idea of gay marriage, and that when those two things were happening, so when you have the infrastructure, when you have the personal experience, and then you have the endorsement of people in positions of cultural power, that all sort of has come together in some ways sort of a perfect storm around marriage, and so we're seeing these sort of pieces all fall into place very rapidly.
So absolutely, the elite piece, the decision makers, the culture brokers have a significant role to play. And I wouldn't want to discount the role of kind of an accumulation of policy decisions, judicial decisions, and legislative kinds of decisions. And there's one story that I wanted to add. This is from the mid-1970s. You were saying before that the same-sex marriage fight for it really does date back to the early 70s. Well, 1975, StoryCorps captured this story of Clelo Rorix, who was a county clerk in Boulder, Colorado. And she got involved in the same-sex marriage debate because someone asked her to, which I think is another key piece here. So she was sitting there in the county clerk's office in Boulder, and a same-sex couple approached her in the office and said, "We want to get married." And she said, okay, well, let me just see. Let me talk to my boss about this for a second. And they figured out that in their law, the way it was configured, there was no explicit prohibition against a same-sex marriage. So indeed, they were given the license. Later on, things didn't turn out so positively. But for her, she actually said that was the first time she had met a same-sex couple, people who were openly out in public. And for her, that was transformative to the point where from 1975, she remembers the story to share with StoryCorps in 2014.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Talk with Madeline Edelman, Associate Professor of Justice and Social Inquiry at ASU School of Social Transformation, and Katrina Kimport, Assistant Professor at the Center for Global Reproductive Health at the University of California, San Francisco. She's also the author of Queering Marriage, Challenging Family Formation in the United States. Katrina, when it comes to same-sex marriage, I don't know if you've had a chance to think about this or look into it, but what other parallels are there in terms of sort of the characteristics that make movements mainstream? This idea of talking about personal experience, as Madeline just did, actually knowing someone who may be going through this. But we think about, when you hear about same-sex marriage now, for example, I'm sure the civil rights movement had similarities too. It feels like those who don't end up supporting it or getting on the bandwagon are sort of those that are considered to be more extreme, whereas other people who come to accept it are sort of like, okay, this seems fine with me. I just hadn't thought about it before.
Well, I think what you're getting at there taps into an idea that social movement scholars talk about in terms of this idea of framing and of cultural resonance. And so this is the other thing that I think is really key in understanding why marriage equality as a claim, as a movement, has emerged at this point. And this fits into this long trajectory of this movement. And what they've done is they've found a way to really tell the story, to tell the message of why marriage is important, and make an argument for it in a way that resonates with listeners. And those listeners, it may resonate because it is consistent with what they know. They know their neighbor, their friend, their cousin has had this experience. And it may also resonate just in terms of their own personal experience, even among heterosexual listeners. And so along these lines, one of the things that we've found is that what the marriage equality movement does very successfully is it mobilizes a framework of talking about marriage in terms of family and in terms of children. And this is distinct from the idea of marriage as a right. And so the stories that are most compelling and that most bring people sort of on board around the idea of marriage are ones that that flag this idea of family. So even Justice Kennedy in his in the decision he wrote that overturned Prop 8 in 2013, that was the California law, he talks about the importance of children, that these that same-sex couples are raising children and they deserve the protections of the law. And so it does move into that rights territory, but it really is what marriage equality has done is really captured this cultural resonance. And so for the people what you were talking about, where it becomes sort of almost common sense, it's because it's consistent with the way that society is currently valuing, what things are happening in people's individual lives, gay or straight. And so I think this is something that the civil rights movement captured at its heyday. At that point, what was most resonant with people was an idea of rights. We've seen that start to the resonance of the idea of a rights frame, that things should happen because of a argument about equal rights. We've seen that start to chip away.
Madeline,
right?
Jump in.
So the voting rights.
Sorry, let me have Madeline jump in.
Sure. I think what Kimberly's pointing out is...
Katrina.
Katrina Kimber. I want to make sure I get your name right. Katrina Kinport. I admire your work. What she was saying about the use of children and family, kind of images of harmony and togetherness and love, and how effective that was, that when same-sex marriage advocates shifted from the rights language to the love language, it resonated, it worked. The irony there is how, for so many decades, children and the vulnerability of children was being used against LGBT activists. So it's a real interesting success here to be able to use the very thing that was used against a movement to have a movement success.
I want to have you both comment on this. Madeline, I want to start with you briefly on this, though. Are social movements inherently scary to the mainstream public in some way? Because it does seem like the initial things, and I'm thinking again of civil rights and same-sex marriage, it almost seems like when people first hear them, because if the average person is not paying attention, people who are opposed try to sort of make them a boogeyman in some sense.
Well, I think social movements are intended to challenge the status quo.
Okay.
So they are inherently threatening in the sense if people are satisfied with or are benefiting from the status quo. So a social movement's job is to create recognition, to create a new problem, whether it's sexual harassment, domestic violence, anti-bullying, same-sex marriage. Social movement's job is to carve out a new niche, a new space for people to think. And for some people who are comfortable, satisfied, or otherwise benefit from how things are the way they are in the world, they may not want that kind of change.
Well, Katrina, that's what I found so fascinating about what you said about elites, this idea that in some cases one would think that elites would be threatened by that. How would you characterize that?
I think that there's one of the things that we do find about elites, though, is that they're usually not at the vanguard of the social movement. Mm-hmm. And so there are steps along the way where it becomes in the elite's best interest, whether it's persuaded for reasons of electability, for reasons of, say, finance. So we find that most Fortune 500 companies were offering domestic partner benefits long before that was a norm, and that was because they were losing employees to competitors who could offer that, both gay employees and some straight employees who consider themselves allies. So I think that there is that piece, and that's in some ways often considered sort of a real turning point in a movement. And it you know, whether it's in the best interest or whether it appeals to a larger, broader sense of justice, I think both of those things are, there's always a complicated calculus when people are going to sign on and support a social change effort.
And finally, we just have about a minute left, and I'm wondering, Madeline, let me start with you. And Katrina, you've been... your book talks about this so much, but I'm wondering going forward, Katrina, this is, and Madeline, let me start with you, though. This idea that there are still obstacles along the way in Arizona, this idea that, okay, it's legal, but what are some things people should still know about the fact that this movement really isn't just done?
Sure. So same-sex marriage is just a sub-piece of a larger social movement to gain recognition, affirmation, acceptance, and protections against discrimination and violence for LGBT people. So as same-sex marriage becomes common sense, as Katrina was saying, we still have to work on applying the laws that we have. We also need to work on building infrastructure to make sure we have robust opportunities to thrive as a community. And then there's very specific issues, whether it's bullying in schools, whether it's violence in the streets, that still require legal and social change.
Katrina, final thoughts on that?
I think that's absolutely correct, that the key is understanding that this is one piece in a larger effort towards reducing the inequality and ending the marginalization of people with non-normative, to use a more jargony term, people outside of the straight majority.
Katrina Kimport is assistant professor of the Center for Global Reproductive Health at the University of California, San Francisco. She's also the author of Queering Marriage, Challenging Family Formation in the United States. Katrina, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Madeline Edelman, associate professor of justice and social inquiry at ASU School of Social Transformation. Madeline, great to have you here. Thanks.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about whether authentic Phoenix is dying. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by True West Credit Union, a full-service financial institution located in the Valley for more than 60 years. If you live in Maricopa County, find out how to become a member at truewest.org, federally insured by NCUA.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and online at kjzz.org. We should see sunny and clear skies in the valley today, a high near 92 degrees. More of the same tomorrow, a little warmer, things getting up to 93, and more sunshine on Friday when the high is expected to be 95 degrees. Join us at 12 o'clock for Here and Now from Boston. Today, Canada's parliament remains on lockdown after a shooting there this morning. We'll get the latest. And NPR's Jason Bowe will talk about his trip to Liberia and how that nation is dealing with the Ebola epidemic. That's coming up at noon on KJZZ. Checking Valley traffic on the State Route 51 northbound, a crash is blocking the right lane at Thunderbird Road. Mostly sunny skies and it's 83 degrees in Phoenix at 11:43.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Karsh's Bakery, a longtime favorite in Central Phoenix, closed its doors in the spring. In recent weeks, Mary Coyle's Ice Cream Shop and Baker's Nursery also decided to go out of business. What has Phoenix lost? On his Rogue columnist site, former Arizona Republic columnist John Talton, who now lives in Seattle, wrote that authentic Phoenix is dying. So what does authenticity mean? Is Phoenix losing it? What's being done to keep that from happening? With me to talk about that is John Talton, now an economics columnist for the Seattle Times. John, good morning.
Hi, Steve. It's good to be with you.
Always good to have you. And with me in studio here in Phoenix is Shannon Scutari, co-founder and director of the Sustainable Communities Collaborative and president of Scutari & Company. Hi, Shannon. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So, John, let me start with you. How would you define what authenticity means and how that affects authentic Phoenix?
Well, this is the hard thing to put your finger on. What I have said about authenticity is that it's a connection with place. It involves historic roots, local ownership, places that are really valued, spaces that people care about, businesses. It's human scale. It encourages human interaction. It has aesthetics, has that distinctive vibe, cool, if you want to call it. Phoenix used to be full of it. There's still some there, but you have to drive a lot to get there. And one of the things that I think really makes an authentic city is density and scale, so that you don't have to drive 10 miles to get from one authentic location to another.
Shannon, what do you think about that, and what's being done to sort of try to preserve that authenticity?
Well, you know, thanks to you. I really do, in a lot of ways, agree with John about we need to nurture authenticity. We need to commit to authenticity. We need to finance things, places, opportunities that actually contribute to authentic places that people feel connected to a sense of community. I agree we have a lack of connectivity that's actually allowed the separation of a lot of those areas that have sprouted up that are authentic. And so, therefore, you kind of have a sort of a sense of despair when you sort of drive from one authentic place to another authentic place. Mm-hmm. You get inspired once you're at the place, but maybe you sort of have to drive through a lot of vacant, open, kind of desolate areas, even in the heart of our urban centers in the valley, before you can get from one authentic place to another authentic place. However, I do believe that authenticity has to exist within the culture of a community. It has to be the celebration of the diversity of the culture of the people. And I would say that the authenticity of our central city of Phoenix is actually being unleashed right now. So I do disagree with John that we're losing it. I think we're gaining it. I think that we have too often tried to gloss over what's truly been the history and the culture, a lot of the Latino influence, the cultural pieces that give us a really rich fabric of authenticity. And those voices more and more now are actually emerging, and they're creating place. Now, maybe John can't see it from Seattle, which I understand, but you have to be here to experience it. And I would say that we're on the cusp of it. We won't see it really in our built environment for probably another, you know, maybe 5-10 years plus.
So, John, has Shannon sold you on that?
Well, I have a condo on the light rail line in Phoenix, so I'm there quite a bit, Shannon. You know, okay. I mean, I'm glad about that. I hope that that happens. I think that you did hit on something, that it has to be part of the culture of the community and the custom of the community, and we have so many people there from somewhere else, and they don't really care about authenticity. Now, you know, Old Phoenix was overwhelmingly an Anglo city compared to Tucson, and there are important Latino fabrics there, but most of them were bulldozed for Sky Harbor. To the extent that that can be brought back, that's great. Now, this is something every city is facing in the age of Amazon, in the age of e-commerce, in the age of these gigantic national and international companies that are fighting to take down local retailers. And so it's not peculiar to Phoenix. I don't want to get Phoenix's defensive radar on. You know, that Talton hates Arizona. Why do you hate Arizona?
We're kind of like the girlfriend. We're kind of like the girlfriend that you still love, I think.
You know, hey, my family goes back 4 generations there, so of course I love Phoenix.
Right.
But I think the issue is, does authenticity matter in drawing young talent, in preserving a sense of place? You know, we've done well with the historic districts. If you look along the light rail line in Midtown, it's just desolation. And this is unprecedented for a city of Phoenix's size. You will not find it anywhere in a city of Phoenix's size, much less in the ones we're competing against for talent and capital, smaller cities like Denver. And so this is not to cause people to want to commit suicide or be in denial or to deny the many good things that are being done by people like Shannon, by people like Kimber Lanning. It is just to say, we need to think about this, and what value does it have? I think a lot.
John, one quick question for you. As someone, again, who has the condo along the light rail, and you've got your little WBI YB that you always like to throw in about the light rail. we built it, you bastards. I think
it's,
yes. So, but
yes,
so,
we did.
So when you think about so light rail, but you're saying Midtown, you're seeing desolation. What is, define that for us? Because some people would disagree with that.
Oh, people disagree with everything I say.
No, when, not everything, John.
when you look at Midtown, the skyscrapers that were built from the 70s through the 90s, you have incredibly high vacancy rates. Oh, all over Metro Phoenix is the highest office vacancy rates of any major city in the country. We don't have the headquarters we once had, the stewards we once had. You know, Park Central is just this kind of dead office space with a great Starbucks and the Good Egg, and I love that. But you can't go shopping in Midtown Phoenix for, you know, you can go to the Walgreens that looks like the Walgreens in suburban Akron, with some rocks around it. But it's certainly not performing where it should be.
Well, John, let me jump to Shannon on this. Shannon, where does something like the Newton fit in? That's something that's got a lot of publicity. And maybe that shows that Phoenix still has a long way to go, because at one place like that, everyone's so excited about it. But it's right along the light rail line. It has a restaurant. It has the bookstore. It has the gardening store. How much can something like that lead to, and how much can that sort of maintain the authenticity of that old Beefeaters kind of space?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's critical. I mean, you have to put the investment into those areas, and they have to be supported by the community. And clearly, that is a perfect example of a place that took an incredible heavy lift from the financing to the investment interest of all of the folks that are leasing up that space and own a piece of that space. They embody community themselves. So then, of course, it oozes community. They offer a very important reinvention of an icon for our area. So they have turned it into, you know, a more modernized version of authenticity for us from the Beefeaters days. There's so many different places. I mean, I don't want things like Creston Ballroom or the Professional Musicians of Arizona that are thriving in you know, the middle of a neighborhood across the street from Tuck Shop, and you know, these areas in you know, Comedor Guadalajara, and this area in, you know, the Autobahn, and all of these pieces that have incorporated nature that are places, they're, yes, in the middle of areas that need a lot of work and need a lot of investment. But all of these different things, including the Newton and Cahoots and Native American Connections and Seed Spot, and I mean, all these things, there's so much happening where there's so many people that are doing a lot. They're spending their life energy and their resources to have authenticity, and those people need to be supported. All of these things should be supported and connected. Now, it is one thing I do like about the transportation infrastructure is it's making an attempt, really. We need to go a long way to create a real total transit system. It's not just about rail, but we're lacking the connection and the support, I think, on a grander scale for those kinds of initiatives.
I should have carved out more time for this segment. John, a minute or so, I'm curious about authenticity. Can authenticity be progressive in the sense that I mentioned Bakers, I mentioned Karsh's and Mary Coyle's and whatnot? Can there be places like that, that a place like the Newton, can that become part of sort of a new authenticity, maintaining some of what was there before and sort of evolving it?
Well, authenticity does evolve. Phoenix became a big city in the automobile age, and then it tore down so much of itself. So it doesn't have the good bones of a lot of places it's competing against. It has very committed people. It lacks capital. It lacks headquarters in the center city that will draw talented people with money. And so I don't disagree with Shannon's commitment and all these good little spots, but there needs to be more attention paid to not tearing down so much, connecting more, getting critical mass.
And you can read former Arizona Republic columnist John Talta at roguecolumnist.com. He's also an economics columnist for the Seattle Times. John, thank you as always.
Thanks, Steve.
And Shannon Scutari, co-founder and director of the Sustainable Communities Collaborative. She's also president of Scutari & Company. Shannon, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Listening to KJZZ's Here and Now, I'm Steve Goldstein. The term science fiction doesn't always make sense because the fiction may not stay that way. Many examples exist of ideas and concepts that seem far-fetched, but wait long enough and they turn out to be true. Science fiction can also be a haven for helping us think about big ideas. That's part of what's behind the new anthology, Hieroglyph, Stories and Visions for a Better Future. Tonight at 7 at Crescent Ballroom in Phoenix, you can be part of the book launch. Here with me to talk about Hieroglyph is one of its editors, Ed Finn. He's also with ASU's Herberger Institute for Design and the Arts. Ed, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how can science fiction and the big ideas of a real future come together, coexist, progress?
So what we've done with this anthology is challenged science fiction writers, scientists, and engineers to come up with really big, ambitious visions of the future that are still technically feasible. Big ideas that we could either do right now if we just had the right story to tell, or that we could do within one professional lifetime. So a young scientist or engineer could read one of these stories and just go for it.
I'm really generalizing here, but it seems like so many science fiction stories are either utopia or dystopia. There's really not much in between, when our real lives really have more in between. How does that fit in this?
So It was actually the dystopian trend in a lot of popular culture that pushed us to make this happen. This all started a couple of years ago at an event where ASU president Michael Crow was talking to the science fiction writer Neal Stephenson, and Crow basically challenged Stephenson to say, you're one of these writers who's very popular, who's written a lot of cyberpunk, a lot of noir stories about people with, hackers with silver sunglasses and knives and swords and, great programming skills who solve problems from the outside, who are rebels. But at their best, those stories are pretty murky. You know, they're not really optimistic narratives. And so Crow challenged Stephenson to say, well, the engineers, the scientists, they read all this science fiction. Many scientists and engineers go into STEM fields because of the stories they read when they were young. Mm. Star Trek is still incredibly powerful in that way. But the stories we're telling now are really negative. Every new Hollywood blockbuster seems to be about the world ending, or even worse, staggering on in some post-apocalyptic state. So what would happen if we came up with optimistic stories and really tried to change the conversation?
Well, but why do you think we reached that stage? Because I think people look back, it's been many decades now, but the space program, people were so excited about that. That was a big idea that people got behind. What happened in the interim that people became, are we getting to be too cynical, too skeptical?
I think there are a lot of answers to that question. The space program was a really interesting one. It's the great example, the Apollo program, that grand challenge. We're going to send someone to put a man on the moon in 10 years. But on the other hand, it was also a military contest. It was about who's going to control space. Is it going to be us or the Ruskies? It was this big global contest over two different systems of thought. And that was scary at times, but it was also a really clear story that everybody could understand and unite behind. And now the stories are not so clear. The world is confusing and murky. We've all become a lot more jaded about the future. And so I think there's a complex feedback loop between science fiction and the stories we tell in popular culture and the stuff we decide to go out and build and make. We just had an event a couple of weeks ago with NASA's chief scientist, and she said a great thing. You can't invent the future until somebody imagines it. You need to have the vocabulary to actually make these things possible.
Well, exactly. Imagination was the first word that came to mind for me. How do you make imagination into something real? And we start off as kids, and everything is possible, and then we grow more and more cynical usually as the years go by.
Yeah, sometimes I think we sort of beat it out of them in school. So I also run the Center for Science of the Imagination at ASU, and this is really our mandate. How do we rekindle that imagination? How do we get people thinking more creatively and ambitiously about the future? And we're experimenting on a lot of fronts with that, with different kinds of events. This book is not the end of a project for us. It's really a beginning and an invitation to people all over the world to join Hieroglyph, the conversation online. It's hieroglyph.asu.edu. We want to have new projects that turn out new stories, but also activities, other kinds of narratives, and practical projects, getting young people around the world to take action in their own lives and feel like they have the power to change their lives.
And finally, I'm someone who still reads a lot of books. I'm someone who likes the paper in my hand, too. But how did you decide this was a good project for getting people involved in these different stories and thinking big?
The good thing about science fiction is that it invites all sorts of people to the conversation. You could be a physicist, you could be a high school student, you could be an artist, you could be a poet. All of those people use imagination, and a good story invites everybody in because it doesn't require you to have all of the physics or be able to sketch out the blueprint for a building. It gives you the thumbnail, and actually the readers do all of the real heavy lifting in any good science fiction story. We imagine that world. We make it real. And if you get people to do that on the page, if you get them invested in making it real through in their own heads, that's the most important step to making it real in the actual world.
So very briefly, has this anthology made you feel more optimistic about this going forward?
It's made me more optimistic about our power to change the conversation. And that's the most important thing.
Ed Finn of ASU's Herbert.